Hello, sports fans, and welcome to another edition of Yesterday Sports on the Sports History Network. And make sure to check out sportshistorynetwork.com/giveaways. I have two signed books I'm giving away. One is titled No Nonsense, Old School Weight Training, and the other is Reliving 1970s Old School Football.
You ever wonder what the early APFA and NFL were like? Well, in this episode, we discuss a real-life look at early pro football history as Simon Herrera, the organizer of Vintage American Football Games, joins us to tell us about his exciting events of he and his fellows playing leather helmet, 3 yards in a cloud of dust football, just like Grandpa would have liked to play, and it's coming up in just one moment. This is the Pigskin Daily History Dispatch, a podcast that covers the anniversaries of American football events throughout history on a day-to-day basis. This is your host, Darren Hayes, and we are podcasting from America's North Shore, bringing you the memories of the gridiron, one day at a time. So in taking the snap from the sportshistorynetwork.com and handing off to pigskindispatch.com, let's go no huddle through today's football history headlines.
This podcast is part of the Sports History Network, your headquarters for the yesteryear of your favorite sport. You can learn more at sportshistorynetwork.com.
Hello, my football friends. This is Darren Hayes of pigskindispatch.com, and welcome once again to the Pigpen. We have another bonus edition for you, and this is something special, something a little bit different. It's a way that you can get a little bit of a taste of some vintage football back in the 1920s era of professional football. And we have a gentleman with us today that is a historian, and he is the organizer of the Vintage American Football Games. And his name is Simon Herrera, and we're going to bring him in right now. Simon Herrera, welcome to the Pigpen.
Thank you. Thank you for having me, Darren. This is great. My first time to the Pigpen here.
Yeah. Please don't mind the mess, because it is a Pigpen, you know. So don't step on any loose corn cobs or anything. So Simon, you have a very interesting topic that we're going to talk about today. But before we get into that, I always like to ask our guests, especially first time on, but where does your football fandom come from? And in particular, that older 1920s, early pro football era. Where does that interest come from in your life?
Well, I grew up in Iowa. There's not a whole lot of pro football in Iowa, but grew up near the Bears and the Packers. So that's kind of, where things started out. In my youth, I was just a huge football fan watching. I grew up a Jets fan because there was no teams really, and I didn't care for the Bears too much. So just since I can remember, I was out in the backyard playing football and trying to get any info I could on the Jets and stuff. And I'll just say what I found out when I got a little bit older was that I had this huge interest in the NFL, but in Rock Island, Illinois, I grew up in the Quad Cities. There was a team that was in the NFL that first year, and I didn't even know. No one ever talked about this when I was growing up, and I couldn't believe that it was even true. So I just started, going down that rabbit hole and just coming across more and more stuff as I researched. So, that's where it came from.
Wow, that's amazing. I'm sure New York Jets Nation is probably very excited. They have some fans in Iowa. So that's
there's a couple of us.
Yeah, you don't hear about that every day.
No. I was just going to say, you don't meet too many Jets fans growing up in Iowa. So it's pretty hard to, have conversations with some of the locals about the team. So,
and they've been kind of hard to talk about lately too, but hopefully they got some better sailing coming up soon. So
who knows?
Now you run an event, almost an organization called the Vintage American Football Games. Can you just give us just a brief description of what that is?
Yeah. I guess I'll sort of say how it started. Doing all my research on the Rock Island team, I always had a fascination with the history and everything. And it was just kind of a thing in the back of my head on, I wonder what it would look like. I found out that the field that they played on in Douglas Park was still there. So, I just did all this research and eventually I put up a website, and someone named Chris Zimmerman, a local there, came across my website and said, "Hey, you're Rock Island Independents. Do you want to play my Moline Universal Tractors and we'll meet down at the park?" So that's kind of how that all started as far as the game itself, just the passion and just sort of thinking like, hey, what does this used to look like? And I told him, well, you know, I've always thought that would be kind of a cool thing, but I'm not sure, you know, if you're really serious on, you know, it'd take a lot of equipment and a lot of planning and all this stuff. So he said he was in, and that's how we started out.
Wow. So you have the Moline Universal Tractors and the Rock Island Independents. I believe both of those were original APFA members. Am I correct on that?
Not the Moline team. They're
no, okay.
They're famous, at least locally, because they were the first after the league formed, you know, on October 3rd, the Bears played a scrimmage game, not a league game, but they played against the Universal Tractors. That was their first game they played after the league formed. And so that's why they're famous. And then the second week they played, the Moline team played against the Chicago Cardinals. So they played very famous opponents right off the bat, and they were shut out in both games, and you know, they never, I don't know if they played maybe one more game after that, but that was it for them.
Oh, well, hey, they got their yeah. claim to fame playing some of the big boys that are still in the NFL. So that's pretty good. So, okay. So you guys got together and you had some teams. How long ago was this? How long have you been doing this game?
Yeah. Our first game was in 2015. And just so you know, we've played six games there in Rock Island. There's a couple in Tennessee, and then we've had one game in Pine Village, Indiana. So we've had 10 games in four different cities, and we've had like five different venues host our games. So, but Chris found me, like I said, and we didn't know what, you know, what this was going to look like. So basically his, you know, we decided to go down to Rock Island Parks and Rec, who owned the field down there, and asked them, could we potentially host a game on your field? We had to fill them in a little on the history because they didn't know really, you know, so, you know, and then working with Chris, he's still around, but he doesn't have the passion for the history like me. He just wanted to be a vintage football team owner, which was, you know, exciting for him. And he knew all the locals there and wanted to, you know, just sort of be a part of that, something to bring, you know, locally some entertainment to the local park and just sort of revive it. So that was his thing. And when he came to me, we kind of had a little rough start because he was thinking, hey, let's just get some old t-shirts and go out there and run around and we'll get a, you know, melon football. And I had a bigger picture idea. I said, we got to get some jerseys. Where we get leather helmets and all this. So we kind of went back and forth. And I remember one time he finally told me, hey, I'm not looking for this to be a TV production here. This doesn't need to be TV ready. And I sort of stuck to my guns. And he eventually, you know, this was early on. He bought in, he found a manufacturer for the jerseys. And I came up with the, what pants we should wear. And I wrote down, you know, all the rules and all that stuff. And like I said, we pitched the idea to the Rock Island Parks and got them to support it and basically host the event at the park. But yeah, that's how it all started out.
Okay. So as long as you got into the equipment there a little bit, now you found somebody to make the jerseys. Now they're like in the authentic colors of the teams that play.
Well, we do the best, you know, through my research, but Rock Island was green and white. They're referenced as the green and white a lot of times in articles, and they might have even been a different color before that. But, you know, back then, a lot of the teams, they just changed uniforms every year based on maybe what was donated to them or whatever. But they definitely wore green and white for some period, and I believe when they were in the NFL. So we found a company, Barbarian, out of Canada, who makes rugby jerseys, and they also had the old style like rugby shirts with the stripes on them. So we asked them, can you make a solid shirt but put some green and white stripes on there? And they custom make everything so that they could, and said, I found an old Rock Island logo with the R and I overlapping, not necessarily from the team, but it's just a logo that's been around forever. And we had them put that on the front and some numbers on the back. Most teams back then didn't have logos on the front, but we wanted it to look, you know, a little bit more modern so people could recognize, oh, this is the Rock Island team, but the stripes on the sleeves were, you know, pretty much identical and everything. So the jerseys, the helmets, the first year we just used some real cheap ones we found online, but we found a guy in Texas, who makes, leather helmets, Pastime Sports. He made them. And, the game in Tennessee, they ended up buying 24 helmets, which I'm currently borrowing from them. I've been borrowing them for a few years. So I have those helmets. So that's what we use. And then the trickiest thing was the pants, because how are you going to replicate those pants? So the first year we used a like long khaki shorts. And since then, if you're familiar with jogger pants, they're usually like a tan color, a sand color. We get jogger pants that are loose, and you can pull those. They're usually elastic around the legs. You pull those up around your calf, and they look a lot like the old football pants. So that's how the uniform came together.
I'm very familiar with the pants because I, you know, was a football official for 27 years. And when I started doing it in the 80s, everybody wore white knickers. So I'm real familiar with how those go. So sometimes they're getting a little bit of uncomfortable. I can't imagine playing in them. So
I'll say about the pants, you know, they're a little bit warm. They're maybe canvas material or something, not really canvas, but they kind of feel like that. So they're definitely a little bit warm, but they're sturdier than the shorts. The shorts we had the first year, we had a couple guys when I went to pull the flags, their shorts got ripped. So these are a little bit better than what we started out with.
That could be a little bit awkward to play a game with the ripped pants in front of a crowd, huh?
Yes.
So, okay. Now you mentioned you're using flags. So you have a little bit, you're not playing all out tackle football, the brutal game that was of the early pro football game. You tamed it down a little bit. So you're running like flag football flags?
Well, about the games, I'll just give you the basics on what we're doing. Sure. It's, you know, besides the jerseys, I guess the other challenge was trying to come up with, you know, the rules. So basically, it's flag football rules. But we modified it, and I was, you know, originally I wanted 11 against 11, but basically in the end, I tell them we shrunk everything by about 20%. So we do 9 against 9 and we play on an 80-yard field, but we're using kind of flag football rules where we just put a first down at the 20-yard line, the 40-yard line, which is midfield, and then the other 20, because we don't have a crew, you know, we can't measure off all the yardage. So that kind of makes it easier. So like I said, 9 against 9, what I did was we just eliminated two of the interior linemen. So we have three linemen, you know, with the center in the middle, and we put two ends, and everybody stands basically fingertip to fingertip apart. So we have some running lanes, you know, where they were at the start, people were worried there's going to be too crowded, there's going to be injuries, you know, some of the, you know, Chris and some of the other referees that were sort of helping us at the start, but we just sort of spread everyone out. And my goal was, I wanted from the sideline, I wanted people to look out there and say, wow, that looks like a 1920s game. And I wanted the players to have that mentality and the strategy, because if you just tell everybody, hey, let's go out and play a flag football game in these old jerseys, they're going to start just throwing the ball. So that's when I came up with, and we found a ball, and now I make my own vintage footballs. Well, I have them manufactured. I designed my own, but I made the ball. It's 24 inches around. That's slightly bigger than what they used back then by about an inch, but I wanted to make it so it was hard to throw, so that when these guys get out there on the field, they're not trying to throw the ball. Because if you throw that ball, you know, more than 10, 15 yards, you kind of have to float it, which is, you know, if you've seen some of the old clips and read some stuff, that floating was or throwing the ball was like a sign of a, you know, weakness rather than running it. So I wanted the game to simulate that. So using the large ball makes it so most of the time you're going to see a run plays. And what we do is we line up in a, basically like a modified shotgun T formation. So we've got a left half back, a right half back, and a center, like a fullback. And the quarterback takes the snap, not from under center, but shotgun. So that's why it's a little bit modified. So the quarterback can call a lot of plays, and basically he'll just say, everyone block to the left. We're going to swing around the right end, point to this guy, you lead block around the right end, and I'll pitch it to you. You know, so we'll do that. We'll do some, you know, you step in front of me. If I'm the quarterback, I might say to the center, you step up in front of me, I'll fake the handoff, and we'll roll around on the right end, and I'll lateral it. So
you're saying this loud enough for the other team to hear, or you're saying it sort of in a code, almost like audibles are today?
Well, we huddle. So like, there's a little difference. Like you said, what's some of the differences between then and now? We'll huddle up and everything, but we'll break the huddle, and we've told the guys what to do on that play. But what we do beforehand, I didn't mention this, we'll have a practice, about 90-minute practice on the day of the game. Everyone will come out a couple hours early, and I'll explain all these rules, and I'll go through and you know, give them all the basic safety rules, but then we basically line up in the one formation, because we don't have a whole lot of time to practice. So we line up in those formations and just run a bunch of plays, run a different plays, and maybe throw to the ends occasionally. And then after we've gone through all that, we'll do like a one quarter scrimmage. So everyone gets a chance to, you know, see how it all works. It gives the referees a chance to, you know, learn how to, you know, spot the ball and everything. So that's the basics of it.
Wow. Okay. That is interesting. Now, how many, I mean, the official in me is like, wanting to throw out all these questions. And I know we didn't talk about some of these things, but how many officials do you have on a field for one of these games?
We'll do four fields is my goal. So, and then we have one guy, I made a down pole, a marker, you know, it's first through fourth down. I'll have somebody over there as part of the referee crew. They all the referees will wear like a white, long sleeve shirt. They can roll up the sleeves and then a little cap. Sometimes they brought out bow ties and I give them all a, you know, like an old school, like brass whistle. They all come out and then they wear tan pants and black shoes. So they're out there. We'll have one official on the offense and one on the defensive side. And then we have one on each side of the team, kind of like the sideline official. So the, you know, I forget the names exactly, the referee and, you know, the side judge and all that, but we basically have four, and the two on the ends on the sides, those, when the ball gets spotted, when it goes, let's say it goes out of bounds, we have hash marks that are 10 yards within the field, which is a rule that they brought up in 1932 for one of those indoor games in Chicago. But that way, when it goes out of bounds, you know, they didn't have hash marks. So, we spot the ball 10 yards inside. So we still are running the plays very close to the sideline, which gives it that authentic look too. But they'll spot the ball, and the other two guys are there just to watch for rough play and make sure the guys line up far enough apart and stuff. There's very few flags in the game, but they're just kind of out there to basically they're helping out, you know, with the players. Sometimes they forget the rules. They're not lined up in the right spot, that sort of thing.
There you go. Okay. Now I was going to ask you that, but you really made me think of this question. Now the 80 yard field, the modified field, and you mentioned that 1932 impromptu championship game where I believe it was the Chicago Bears challenged the Portsmouth Spartans because they had the same record at the end of the season. And they were supposed to be at, I believe, Wrigley Field, but the heavy snowfall pushed it into an indoor stadium in Chicago. So they had to modify it. Is that sort of why you have the modified field? Is it in honor of that game, or did you have some field restrictions at your sites?
A little bit of field restrictions because we were playing on the actual field where the Independents played, but it's still, it's a baseball field. So we're playing across the outfield kind of sideways there. Okay. So when I talked to the guy who's going to lay out the field, that was his recommendation. And plus we put the goalpost like they did back then on the goal line. So it just kind of worked out really good to have an 80 yard field. And then I thought, well, since we've limited the players to 9 against 9 and most of us are over, you know, 30 years old, let's just make it 80 yards. And we shrunk it by about 20% too on the width. So it just kind of worked out good.
Yeah, I'd throw out there that you're paying tribute to the 1932 game. That's pretty cool, too. So, I mean, that's awesome that you're playing on the original field, too. That's amazing.
Well, one thing we do similar to that is in that game, I believe they had a touchback at the 10-yard line. So I do that as well. I guess I'll say in honor of that game, right?
Yeah, there you go.
We start at the 10 and on a touchback. So you are kind of backed up and you got the wooden goalpost there right behind you. So you really can't go backwards. The first down is then at the 20. So that first time you get the ball, if you got a touchback, you only got to get 10 yards. And then from there on, you got to get to the 40 for the next first down. But I kind of like the 20 yard distance because if it was only 10 yards, there'd be a lot more first down. So this makes the game a little more realistic too, because you'll see a lot of punts like they did back then. So.
Okay. Now, I guess speaking of the kicking game, what do you do as far as you have the goalposts? You have like a regular kick for point, or do you include some of the forgotten kicking practices like drop kicks?
Well, yes, I wanted to encourage drop kicks, but it's kind of hard to do. So the kicking is a little different. Back then, from what I know, I think in 1920 it was this way, but after a touchdown is scored, they would just line up across the 20 and do a free kick. They could have a holder hold it, or they could do a drop kick. So we have the team I scored upon, they stand in the end zone. It's kind of their punishment, I guess, for giving up a touchdown. And the other guys line up across the 20. And just like I said, you can have somebody hold it and kick the extra point. So I believe that's how it was then. You know, they had the punt out kick that was before then, where they would actually have to kick the ball out of the end zone. We don't do that. By 1920, they were doing a regular extra point, and I believe it was non-rushed. So to encourage a drop kick, though, I changed it a couple years ago. So if you did a drop kick from the 20, it was worth 2 points, which they didn't have 2-pointers then, but I figured no one's going to ever do a drop kick unless I, you know, give them some incentive.
Yes, that's a good idea. Now, do you have people that try the drop kick with that extra point advantage?
I can't remember if anyone else. I've done a couple, I think, and I made them. So I don't remember if anyone else has officially tried a drop kick. But
I wonder, it's got to be maybe a little bit easier with that larger girth ball that you're using, as opposed, you know, you said you're using a 24 inch diameter ball. The current NFL balls that are played on Sundays, those are 21 inches, I believe. So you're quite a, I mean, you're going beyond what the melon ball is, I think. So
by about 1 inch, yes. But yeah, they're rounded on the ends, so if you sort of angle them backwards and drop them, they usually bounce a decent amount, probably too much. So you got to kick it right as the ball's hitting the ground. So
it's gonna be almost like kicking a medicine ball almost.
Yep.
Interesting. And you said it's kind of infrequent that people are passing the ball.
Yeah. It's a little bit dangerous because it is such a larger ball, and you know, our quarterbacks aren't necessarily, you know, trained as well as most quarterbacks. And we've had a few former high school and semi-pro quarterbacks out there, but just an average guy trying to throw that ball 15, 20 yards, he's going to float it. So it's a dangerous strategy. I've thrown plenty of interceptions.
So your strategies of making it a run game have been extremely effective, I take it then.
Yes. A lot of running, which, I guess I'll tell the story. One of the thing that was cool the very first year, because I, you know, I didn't know how this was going to go, but the first year I was in there on offense, quarterback, or no, I think I played in that first year, and I caught a touchdown. And then I had to do, you know, the local press was out there, and they were all, you know, thought this was cool, and they wanted to talk to me because they knew I was an organizer. And I went over there and talked to them, and then some of the fans came up to me and said, "Wow, this is amazing. Where did you find these guys? Are these guys traveling, you know, they do this like for shows or something?" And I said, "No, we practiced this morning. This is, you're watching a real football game, you know." So that was, you know, that was nice of them to think that the game was, you know, just sort of a stage setup. They thought it was like an act, and, you know, it was kind of, we were faking everything. I said, "No, these guys are out there running around, you know, playing a real game." So,
That's neat. Now, how many teams are involved in this for this coming year? You've got one coming up, I believe, in August. How many teams would be participating?
This year we're going to do in August, we have the Pine Village game, which, the Pine Village team, they were famous, you know, they were around since 1898, I believe. They only lost, I think, maybe 5 or 6 games in 20 years. So in that town, there's still a marker for the team. And they saw what I was doing and asked if, you know, I'd be interested in coming up there and trying to help them put on a game. So that's, we did that in 2019, and we were doing one on August 14th. Since I didn't have any jerseys for a visiting team, I just borrowed the Rock Island jerseys from the Rock Island Parks. They had helped us purchase a set back in the beginning. And then this year we changed it up. The county they play in is Warren County. So they're the Warren County All-Stars, we call them. And they kind of represent all the teams that were from the area that played against Pine Village. And famously, in 1915, they hired in Jim Thorpe in Pine Village, and they beat the Purdue All-Stars. So that's why we kind of wanted to use the All-Stars name, but just sort of make it so and a lot of guys, they wanted to play on the Pine Village team. So they said, you know, we want to make it, if you can't play on their team, you know, you're probably from Warren County anyway, so you play on the Warren County All-Stars. So we got those two teams. And then, of course, the Rock Island team, we're going to play September 11th and October 2nd. One game at Douglas Park and one game at a 1920s mansion. And they're going to play against Des Moines Universal Tractors again this year.
Now's a good time to take a break from our football history discussion and hear from one of our sponsors, Row One Brand. At the Sports History Network, we're all about sports yesteryear, and so we're so pleased to introduce you to Row One, an online memorabilia gallery and shop that brings your sports history to life anywhere. The Row One Gallery includes over 5,200 gorgeously reproduced prints of team posters, game program covers, game tickets, advertisements, and more in baseball, pro and college football, pro and college basketball, and more. And any gallery item may be printed in a variety of sizes on wood, metal, canvas, acrylic, or poster paper. And in Row One Shop, check out the thousands more of you unique items with a retro and historical designs dating back to 1876, including t-shirts, long sleeve shirts, phone cases, mugs, blankets, pillows, towels, and even shower curtains. Go to sportshistorynetwork.com, ROW number one, for access to the full Row One catalog and for gallery prints and gift items. Plus, get a 15% discount off all prints on the Row One Pictorum Gallery with coupon code SHN15. Follow the link on the show notes. Simon, what are some of the early rules that you use that may be foreign to some of the modern observers watching the game?
The first thing, well, like since we've talked about the limiting passing, one thing that makes it even harder in the passing game is that back then, if you threw a pass into the end zone, it went over the goal line or out the side or out the back, or just if it hit the ground or, you know, it wasn't caught. Basically, it's kind of like now when you fumble the ball in the end zone, it's a touchback. So that's one of the rules that, you know, most people don't know anything about or didn't even know. And we'll be playing a game and somebody will chuck it in the end zone and they'll go to huddle up. And we're like, nope, that's a touchback. That's a turnover. You know, and we tell them that in the practice and everything, but it doesn't really come up usually until the game. And so I love that rule. It would take away from throwing in the end zone now. So I guess it wouldn't really work nowadays, but that's one of my favorite things about our game is when there's a touchback on an incomplete pass into the end zone. And then I had touched on it earlier, the sidelines. We don't have hash marks. So when you go out of bounds, the ball will be spotted by the side referee 10 yards in. So we do put a little line on the lines that go across field, a little hash there. And then when you run a play, you can't really run it towards the sideline. So everyone knows the play is going back towards the middle. So it's a little bit of an advantage to the defense when you're pinned over on the sideline. So that's just another bit of strategy that we have in the game that was, you know, something they had to deal with back then. And then the final thing that's a little different is we had talked about the drop kicks, making an extra point worth two if they make it from the 20. That's not one of the rules from back then, but something I incorporated just so people could actually see someone attempt a drop kick.
Yeah, I think that's a pretty cool twist that you came up with because it really adds some flavor to it and gives us some, you know, maybe not from that era, but it gives you some good flavor of old time football. So yeah, yeah, I like that. Now who plays in these games? What kind of walks of life of people and age groups play?
Well, most of the people are local to the Quad Cities. But I mean, what's cool is we've had a lot of, dads that want to play and then they'll come out and play and then they'll bring their son out the next year. So we've had several father son duos on the team. In Rock Island, there's a lot of local history there. So, we've had a lot of, former Rock Island High School football players, and some of them played semi-pro. So we've had some very competitive games. I'm, in my 40s now, and I've been out there and there's guys I shouldn't even be on the field with, but we kind of try and split it up a little bit, split up the old guys and make it so the game is, it's going to be competitive for sure, but make it so it's close and fun for everyone. And we've got people that there's some people that have been interested in what I'm doing and they have wanted to put on their own games, but it's a little bit of a challenge, obviously. And it's a little bit of money at the start. So there's people from Chicago, St. Louis, up in Wisconsin. There's a guy and his brother that have played that moved away to California that are flying out this year for the game. And so it's all sorts of people, all sorts of ages. You know who Roy Tsai is? He's part of the PFRA. He comes out there and plays. So, I like to keep it open to pretty much anyone who's got a passion for football and, old football who wants to be a part of it. I don't try and turn anyone down. They just have to, love the game and appreciate what we're doing.
Yeah, I've seen some photos on your website with Roy with the ball in his hand. Yes. Looks like he's got some good footwork going on there.
Yep. I put on that picture, I think I put on Facebook, and I put Roy breaks out into the clear. And some people commented, like, I'd hate to see what everyone else looks like. Roy's out in the open there. So. Oh, but we got a couple yards off the play, so.
That's good. I'm sure he had the thrill of his life too. That's great.
Oh yeah.
All the photos looks like everybody's really enjoying themselves.
Yep. That's what's fun. It's a community thing. One other story about, you ask about who plays in the game. One of the people, the first year when, before we had our first game, there was an event at Rock Island Library and some people came out to that event. And I'd already been researching the independents for several teams. And this lady came up to me and said that her dad had played on the Rock Island team. And I said, your dad, she was only in her 50s or 60s, right? And I said, how is it? You mean your grandpa? She's like, no, my dad, because he had had her way later in life. And so she, you know, we started talking and she introduced me to her son. This is Sandy Wiederquist and Mike Ingholm is her son. He says they were interested. You know, I kept in touch with them. And then when I started the game, of course, they were some of the first people I reached out to. Would you be interested in playing? And of course he wanted to play. And that first game, it was so cool because he was out there playing and the mom came up to me, you know, at halftime saying, this is the greatest thing ever. And he looks just like my dad out there. You know, she was emotional. And so we've got, you know, several players that, you know, have family ties to the original team that come out and play. So it's just
that's awesome.
A good thing for their community. And that's why you said a lot of people out there are smiling and happy just because it's a fun thing.
All right. Yeah, that, I mean, that's incredible. I can't imagine the emotions I had to go through that lady's eyes. So seeing her son, you know, reminding her of her father, you know, back in his glory days running down the field.
Yep.
So that's a pretty cool thing. Now, is there anything that maybe that's something that you and your fellow participants have learned about these early games that maybe you didn't know before, that now that you've lived sort of in their cleats?
Well, I'd say at least myself, I'll start. You know, I just think of the Rock Island Independents. One of their first owners was Walter Flanagan, and not just him, but, you know, before the NFL started in the 1900s through, you know, 1915 or so, they were just like city teams, you know, neighborhood teams, semi-pro, not even semi-pro, just like neighborhood teams, really. And so I'm kind of like walking in their shoes, like trying to organize this stuff. And, you know, they had to write in the papers and say, so-and-so wants to challenge you to a game, or when the season would start, they'd say, do we have any interest? Come to this meeting down at the local bar. And if we have enough interest, we'll form a team this year. So, you know, every year I'm out there, you know, trying to ask these, you know, do you guys want to do another game this year? I got to talk to, you know, Rock Island Parks. Are you guys up for another game? You know, we got interest. All right, can we get some players? So I'm walking in their shoes, kind of just doing something that's, you know, new and original. So I've learned a lot and appreciate everything they went through. And it's just amazing. It turned into, you know, a league that's became the NFL, and then they went through their struggles in the early years. So, you know, with some of the same things and, you know, player jumping and all that. I don't have to deal with the salaries, luckily, but, but that, and then, you know, when you get out on the field, you know, you're playing both ways. We've played in some miserable weather. Actually, we've played in 90 degrees and we've played in like a snow flurry. So, you know, you appreciate these guys out there when it's, especially when it's hot and you don't have a bunch of subs. So, you know, back in the day, these guys, they played both ways and they had no subs. And, you know, it was a sign of weakness if they came out of the game or called a timeout. So, you know, you can appreciate, you know, it wasn't as organized as now, but these guys back then were in great shape, you know, to be able to do that for, you know, both ways for, you know, an entire game. So
it probably most of them have traveled by train all night to get to some of these places. I slept in a box car or something and rolled out and got one on the football field. Ah, that's amazing. Yep. Amazing. Okay. Now, if somebody wants to participate or even, you know, maybe come and watch the games, and how can they learn more about these vintage games?
You can go to Instagram or Facebook and just look up Vintage American Football. And then on Facebook, we have a page called the Rock Island Vintage Football. That's a page. And then Pine Village Vintage Football. So, you know, you can reach out to me there. And then my email that I use is vintageamericanfootball@gmail.com. So, I mean, anyone who's interested, we have three games this year. It'd be August 14th here in Pine Village in a couple of weeks. And then September 11th in Rock Island at Douglas Park. And then October 2nd at the Hallberg House in Rock Island, which is like a 1920s mansion. So those are the three dates. You know, if you're interested, you know, let me know if you want to come watch. We can use volunteers. We have a couple player openings, you know, generally there's people that drop out. So if somebody, you know, hears this and says, wow, I really want to do this, just send me an email and we'll try and work with you. And then I've had several people contact me about organizing games and, you know, in their area. And when I was at the PFRA convention, I was talking to someone about, wow, we should maybe do a, you know, Massillon versus Canton. That would be a great thing to do.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that would.
But, But, you know, I don't live there. So it's like, it takes locals on the ground, somebody to have the passion and say, yeah, I'd like to help organize that. And basically what I say is I have, you know, the footballs and the rules and all that stuff. But if you can find a local organization, a nonprofit or city park or somebody that wants to host something like that, and you get them to, you know, kind of agree to host event, I can travel with my stuff and we can, you know, try and put on a game. I've had a few people where we've tried and it hasn't worked out, and they end up just saying, well, just come play in your game since I can't get one organized in my city. But, you know, that's where it starts, is trying to find someone locally that is willing to put in the time and has the passion for it.
Well, I mean, I don't know where you find the time, because I mean, first of all, it's a brilliant idea what you did. And secondly, we're all about preserving football history, and what better way to preserve football history than to display some football history to folks around and some people to participate in even. And, you know, we're glad you're doing it and really appreciate you joining us today to talk about this. And wish you good luck here for these three upcoming games. We're going to put your links in our show notes. And also, I guess before we let you go, I also saw you had like some stores, like an Etsy store where you sell some, you know, t-shirts talking about your game, but you also have some vintage, some of your jerseys, it looks like, on there also.
Yeah, the jerseys, they're a little harder. I got a few made the first year or two, and then, you know, we had some of the organizations help us buy sets. They're not cheap, so I have a couple of those left. I do have some more Rock Island Independence jerseys that I have for this year's game. So yeah, you can go to Etsy, and the company, on the name I go by there is Vintage Merchandise Company. CO, I guess, Vintage Merchandise Co. Or you can just search like 1920s vintage football and you'll see my football. But what I've focused on definitely this year is, you know, I had to, that first year had to borrow or, you know, find a football, and, you know, I decided to try and design my own football a little bit better. I wanted it a little bit bigger and everything. So I've actually had four different balls made. I've gone through the process, so this is my fourth one. So I'm pretty happy with it. It's made of buffalo leather. It's very sturdy, and the ball is, like, I've kicked it around hundreds of times, and it still looks brand new. It's probably better for displaying. It's a smoke color tan football, like I said, and it looks like a melon football, but it looks great, and I'm happy with it. And that's the ball we're going to use at the games this year. And actually, one other thing I didn't bring up about the Pine Village game, I'm excited because we're going to do a 50-50 for the city. They have like a, you know, they're trying to do some fundraising for some local historical stuff. So I'm donating the game ball to the 50-50 thing. So somebody gets to win that, that ball, which is broken in and, you know, looks beautiful. So,
wow, but that is, yeah, really awesome.
Yep. Visit me at Etsy if you're interested in seeing what those balls look like.
Okay. Well, Simon Herrera of the Vintage American Football, thank you for organizing this, and thank you for joining us here today and telling us all about your game. And we wish you luck, and everybody stay safe in that game.
All right. Will do. And thanks a lot, Darren, for having us. And thanks for the time here at the Pig Pen.
That's all the football history we have today, folks. Join us back tomorrow for more of your football history. We invite you to check out our website, pigskindispatch.com, not only to see the daily football history, but to experience positive football with our many articles on the good people of the game, as well as our own football comic strip, Cleat Marks Comics. Pigskindispatch.com is also on social media outlets, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and don't forget the Pigskin Dispatch YouTube channel to get all of your positive football news and history. Special thanks to the talents of Mike and Gene Monroe, as well as Jason Neff, for letting us use their music during our podcast.
This podcast is part of the Sports History Network, your headquarters for the yesteryear of your favorite sport. You can learn more at sportshistorynetwork.com.
Hey there, football fans. This is Ross, the host of the Pigskin Tales podcast. I just need a few moments of your time to talk about the host of the Pigskin Dispatch podcast, Darren Hayes. He's expanded the Pigpen to search out information on the history of all team sports. It's a quest to find out about the competitors, teams, and places chronicled throughout athletic history through the uniforms and gear the participants used and wore. And he is taking you, the listener, with him on this educational journey to preserve sports history on the Sports Jersey Dispatch, found here on the Sports History Network. His newest podcast, called Jersey Dispatch, is all based on the jerseys that all the greats used to wear. You can find Darren Hayes and the Pigskin Dispatch podcast, as well as Jersey Dispatch, on your favorite podcast provider multiple times each week. So remember that Darren Hayes, the host of the Pigskin Dispatch and Jersey Dispatch podcasts, is found right here on the Sports History Network.